You're listening to In Network, Nordic's podcast series where we explore healthcare and technology with experts from around the globe.
Hello, and welcome to the In Network podcast feature, Designing for Health. I'm Nordic's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Craig Joseph. What do vaccine hesitancy, antibiotic overuse, and the psychology of hypocrisy have in common? They're all tractable problems if you understand how human behavior actually works. On this episode, I'm joined by Michael Hallsworth and Meredith Jones from the Behavioral Insights team, one of the world's leading applied behavioral science practices. We dig into how simple, evidence-based communication tools can change clinician prescribing behavior at a population scale, why the most relatably imperfect doctor may be more effective than the perfectly healthy one, and how metaphors shape patient beliefs about health responsibility more than any education campaign ever will. If you're leading a health system and wondering why your quality initiatives keep stalling, this conversation will reframe the problem in ways that are both uncomfortable and immediately actionable. Let's plug in. Hello, and welcome to the podcast. Where do we find you both today?
I'm in Brooklyn, New York, downtown Brooklyn, looking out over a beautiful sunny winter day.
Is there snow?
No. Okay. Absolutely not. That would make it not very beautiful.
Okay, that's fair. And Michael, where are you? You're in a more in a very different place.
I'm in a recording booth in a studio near Times Square in Manhattan. It is windowless and quite small to make me sound good. I'm here recording the audiobook version of my book. So it's a weird timing that we just happen to be doing this on this very day where I'm in this very strange place.
You say it's weird timing. I say it's just I'm really good at what I do when it comes to scheduling, but it's probably more of the former. So tell us about your book. So you have a book that just came out a few months ago, I think, and you're now recording the audio version of it. Tell us about it, The Hypocrisy Trap.
Yeah, it's a book about hypocrisy, why it bothers us so much, how we need to rethink it, actually, because our relentless desire to sort of stamp out all hypocrisy is actually causing problems in society. It's leading people to have nowhere to go to sort of display those inconsistencies that actually lead us to be human. And it can lead to us thinking the concept is meaningless, because if everything's hypocrisy, nothing is. And that can lead to a kind of really cynical world in which all that matters is the degree of power you have, and principles go out the window. So I spent a long time thinking about this, and I realized that actually hypocrisy was a way of understanding a lot of what's going on in society and the way we deal with each other.
Well, I look forward. We're definitely going to get into it a little bit more. Let me take a step back and let's talk about your background. So Meredith, why don't we start with you? Your interest in behavioral science began in nursery school. Is that accurate?
So in undergrad, I studied cultural anthropology and human physiology. Eventually, those came together to be public health. And when I was getting my master's, I had to do a lot of research and study into different health behavior theories. And they never really fully clicked for me. Like, something was always a little bit off about them. And then I took a health economics class and I learned about behavioral science. And I think it was like finally the missing piece for me. Eventually, I found my way to BIT. And so I've been here for almost 7 years. And I think that what I really enjoy about BIT and about behavioral science is that it just challenged me to think about public health a little bit differently. Mm. I think it really radicalized how I think about access and making things easy. And I think it really pushed me on seeing outside of kind of like the more classic public health interventions and approaches like education. And it also really helped, I think, reframe kind of individual health failings as failings of a system that's not designed for us, rather than failings of a person. So I came to behavioral science through public health. And I really love what behavioral science has to offer that field.
Okay, that's awesome. So to unpack that a little bit, you said BIT, which is, I believe, an abbreviation of Behavioral Insights Team. That's the name of the company that you work for. And as I understand it, it kind of started out as part of the UK government. So So Michael, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got to behavioral science and then also your involvement with the Behavioral Insights team?
Sure. So I came at this from the perspective of public policy and how to improve the evidence we can use when we're making policies, when government's trying to make decisions. So back in 2008-09, there was a book that came out called Nudge, which sold a lot of copies. It generated a lot of interest among policymakers, but it wasn't very clear how you'd apply any of this stuff in practice. I was at an organization called the Institute for Government, which is like a think tank in the UK. And we were commissioned by the government of the time to say, how would you actually apply this stuff in practice? You know, the thing that we read in the book that's interesting, well, what do we do? And that became a kind of influential framework, which also helped set up the Behavioral Insights team BIT in 2010. At that point, it was part of the UK government. Since 2014, it's been a separate organization that kind of expanded around the world and now has around 250 people. I kind of joined the team early on and tried to, you know, put this stuff into practice and show what difference it could make in the real world by, you know, running tests as well, showing we can make this much improvement for this cost. And that proved pretty interesting to people and quite effective as an approach.
All right. Well, that's super interesting. So you kind of both came from different perspectives, but ended up at the same place. I think one of the first projects that I read about that I think would be interesting to kind of dig down deeper into is vaccine hesitancy. Never could it have been more appropriate than now to talk about that. One of the things that your group has done is work with physicians and other providers about having effective conversations with vaccine hesitant patients. I'm a pediatrician. I've had to do this from time to time. Let me now go into all the training that I had to discuss that. Okay, we're done with that now. So that was all the training, as in there was no training. at least in my day, kind of made that stuff up as we went along. So Meredith, why don't we start with you? Like, how should you have those conversations? What have you and your team learned about vaccine hesitancy and helping people explain why vaccines are so beneficial?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that we've done a lot of different work in this space, thinking about ways to increase vaccine uptake, you know, both in improving the conversations between patients and providers and in other avenues. But something that strikes me as a really interesting project and something that we'd love to find ways to kind of scale is a training around conversational receptiveness. So conversational receptiveness is the use of language to communicate your willingness to engage with someone who might have opposing views, someone who might disagree with you. And you can imagine that would be a patient, a parent, or you know, an adult who is vaccine hesitant. So a few years ago, we worked with the University of Louisiana Lafayette to design a training for vaccine campusers. And the content of the training was based off of original work and paper done by Dr. Julia Minson and her team at Harvard on conversational receptiveness. And so what we did is we used a mnemonic called HEAR, and I can describe kind of the four different elements of that to help them prepare to have conversations that might be a little bit heated, or you know, they might be engaging with somebody who disagreed with them. So the mnemonic was HEAR, and it stood for first, hedge your claims. So find ways to demonstrate humility and show that you're aware of the nuance. So you could, you know, use words like might or most or somewhat. You want to try to emphasize agreement. So while the focus of the conversation, you know, is on vaccines and getting vaccinated, you can also look for other kind of points to agree on and point them out. And it's a way of emphasizing agreement about more than just the topic at hand. You know, for example, you're both concerned about the health of your family members. A stands for acknowledge other perspectives. So paraphrasing what others said, but doing that in a genuine way, not trying to do kind of a repeat back that sounds robotic, but trying to do that in a way that really conveys the sentiment that you hear them. And then the last piece is reframing to positive. So framing ideas and messages in a more positive way to express that you can kind of like come to peace with wherever that discussion is going. And so the idea was that the training had, here's this mnemonic, try it. It was a lot of role playing, try and get folks ready and prepared for these conversations. But we want to move that into a more scalable model because we think that there's a lot of benefits and not just giving people tools to talk about vaccines, right? But there's probably a lot of spillover into other topics. So when a patient really wants antibiotics, and that's not the best course of treatment, we can use these tools to have a better conversation. And it might not change the behavior in that particular appointment, right? But the idea is that it has built a more trusting relationship that could ultimately shift behavior down the road. So that was a long answer to your question that I think vaccine hesitancy is really difficult. And in terms of one kind of behaviorally informed conversational tool that you could provide providers, I think that it has a lot of promise.
I love that concept of conversational receptiveness. That you really have to be in a position where you're ready to hear the words and acknowledge where both sides are on the, at least coming from different viewpoints with potentially different basic understandings of what's going on. It would be great if that kind of got into training for physicians and nurses and all kinds of clinicians, because your point's well taken. This is not just vaccines. This is everything. I saw this medication advertised on TV, and they said I should talk to my doctor about it. I want it. Why would I not want it, right? And so there's going to be lots of things where that kind of mindset and coming to the middle are very helpful. Michael, you were nodding along. Anything you wanted to add on conversational receptiveness or other work around those kinds of topics?
I think conversational receptiveness highlights the fact that often behavioral science is about taking practices that already exist, that some people doing well, and sort of systematizing them. Mm. Because I think there are people out there who will be doing this stuff already, maybe not thinking about it so much, but they know it works. And maybe their colleagues copy it as well as a tactic. And I think what behavioral science can do is sort of say why that works and package up in a way that makes it easier for others to use as well. So it may not be a completely new thing. It may be good practice that already exists that then is used more widely.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. I remember as a resident, someone came to me in the middle of the night and said, can you go and explain this to this parent? I've been trying and it's not working. And I'm not sure I did it any better, but I probably came at it from a slightly different viewpoint. And sometimes that's all it takes. Yeah, I do love that idea of kind of systematizing it so that it's more available to lots of other people. Michael, one of the things that you mentioned when we were preparing for this call was your work with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation about metaphors and how they can kind of shape beliefs about healthcare and healthcare responsibility. And so let's kind of dig into that. Isn't it true that I'm just a patient and I don't have any responsibility and it's just all on the clinician to do everything for me? Is that not accurate? Am I misstating anything here?
So yeah, the thing that we did with Rob Wood Johnson Foundation was around narratives and how people present issues to themselves and to others. So in behavioral science, we talk about framing, the idea that you emphasize certain parts of an issue more than others, and that really, really affects how we think of solutions. The different kind of metaphors that we use to talk about, for example, crime or a different kind of issue can lead to completely different natural-seeming remedies. Mm. And so for the work with Rob Wood Johnson, we were looking at how do people think about the responsibility for their own health? This is back during COVID-19, for example, was one thing we looked at, whether it was seen as your fault that you got COVID or whether you were put in a situation that meant you were exposed to other people more. This really affected whether people had supportive views around things like paid leave for sickness and so on, how they kind of apportioned blame and so on. Mm. A lot of these ideas about how we blame certain people or we think that certain people are responsible or not responsible are formed by the simple kind of narratives that we use about health. And what we did was basically vary these narratives. And we found that, yeah, that a different narrative led to a different view about who was responsible, but also then what policies are appropriate to deal with the health issue, depending on who was responsible for it. And that was things like the amount of leave people have, other who funds what, the role of health insurance. So zooming out, you know, these metaphors, these framings that we have all the time in our lives influence what we think is right and what we think is appropriate without us even realizing them. Mm. And so just simply using different metaphors point people in different directions.
Can you give us some examples of one metaphor that was particularly illustrative of this idea?
The narratives kind of asked about, they had a character, I believe his name was Nathan. He was a fast food worker who goes to a barbecue and is exposed to COVID-19. And they varied in how they framed the causes of and the solutions for his subsequent kind of health and financial issues. The financial issues were a fallout of not being able to go to work, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, as Michael said, we asked folks about their pre-existing beliefs. We presented them with one of four different narratives that had these different variations. And then we measured whether or not we saw any shifts in beliefs or attitudes or support for some of the policy changes or broader policies and policy changes that he recommended or that he suggested. That's kind of what they varied on. I thought what I found really interesting was that maybe this is not so exciting, but like a more middle of the road approach seemed to work the best for a wide variety of folks. So I think that what we found was that people can see the system. You can use a narrative approach, position someone's behavior and the consequences in this like larger system and world that we live in. And people can see those things, but they don't want to fully shift the responsibility from Nathan to the system. They want it to be shared throughout. And so I think that one finding was that narratives that are either all focused on Nathan or all focused on the system didn't resonate as much. People kind of recognized that there was some sense of shared responsibility amongst all of these different layers and levels. But what I found really promising is that we didn't see evidence of a backfire effect. What we were really interested in was that how does someone's pre-existing beliefs impact their ability to absorb the new narrative? And what we did not see evidence of backfire effect. And so I think that's promising, right? It means that even if you have a more conservative audience or a more progressive audience, they can receive a new narrative about something without having a dramatic backfire effect, at least in our experiment.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's actually really important. You don't want to end up in a worse place than where you started with. Meredith, one of the things that you mentioned when we were talking about, you know, different ways of having a conversation was antibiotics. And so let me kind of dig deeper into antibiotic stewardship. I know the team, I'm not sure which of you is working on this, has worked on decreasing overuse of antibiotics in UK, Australia, New Zealand. Michael, this is you. So what happened? We all know that if you get antibiotics when you don't need them, it not only is it harmful to you, but it can also be harmful to others by promoting organisms that become resistant. So we don't want to use antibiotics unnecessarily. So how do you get that message out?
The use of antibiotics has been increasing in recent decades, and that drives antimicrobial resistance, which you mentioned, and is, you know, a real threat to medicine as we know it. You'll get people dying of small kind of infections, small cuts and so on, if antibiotics stop working. Surgery will become much more dangerous. There have been various attempts to reduce unnecessary use of antibiotics. One of the main ways has been to pay physicians to reduce their prescribing of antibiotics. The problem is that it's like a collective action problem. In every individual instance, it may be rational for a doctor to just prescribe the antibiotics, maybe because they feel like the patient wants them. It'll be awkward if they don't. But collectively, as we do this, we all lose. And so we thought about addressing this issue in a different way by drawing on the concept of social norms. And this is where you are influenced by what others do in a similar situation. And there's evidence that medical professionals may be particularly influenced by what their peers do. I mean, it's maybe a natural part of the process. Like, how do you treat this particular case? And so we took the data, and this was back 10 years ago now in the UK, we took the data on how much doctors were prescribing, and we isolated when people were outliers. You know, they were prescribing much more than their peers. And we told them that fact. We gave them what's called social norm feedback about how they compared to similar others. And then we measured to see if you got that letter, did you end up prescribing fewer antibiotics? per head than someone who didn't get it. It was a randomized trial. Now, consider this. Usually, if you came up with this idea, and this was done with the UK government, the default would be send it to everyone, right? Because it's like a general communication. We convinced them to randomize, and this revealed that sending the letter did reduce antibiotic prescribing by about 1% in overall in the whole country. Mm. So England's prescribing antibiotics went down by 1%, one percentage point as a result. And that was roughly equivalent to the effect they had got from a multi-million pound incentive scheme. So social norms messaging can actually make a difference to real world physician behaviors. And this approach has now been used in many different countries, has had similar results, and is kind of incorporated as part of the standard approach to antimicrobial stewardship in many countries. It's not going to solve the problem overall, like completely. You need to do other things as well. But it was a part of the jigsaw that was really absent until we did this work, I would say. Or at least this work was a major part of the evidence that led to this approach being used in many different countries now. And you really do need a worldwide response to this, because the bacteria don't care which country you're in. They will develop regardless. So yeah, it was a really big piece of work for us.
I've certainly seen it. Physicians in general are so competitive. At least I'll speak in the US, but I don't think it's very much different in the UK. We're so competitive. And I have certainly seen physicians who have gotten that kind of feedback that you just described. You know, hey, here's this thing that we want you to do, and you're not doing it as much as this these other people. And it's often, I should say often, the few times I've seen it happen, it's very effective actually when you get a list of your peers who are doing this thing better than you. So it's not just you're outside of the average, but no, here's a list of doctors that are doing this thing that we think is good, and you're not doing as much. They're doing it better than you or more often than you. I have seen physicians say, you know, I don't really believe that this is important, this whole antibiotic overuse thing that you talk about. It's all flim-flam science. I don't really believe it. I don't think it's important. However, I will not let that person do better than me on anything, because that guy over there, he is just no good. I don't like that guy. He can't be a good doctor. And if there's anything that you're measuring that's important, I'm going to beat him on it. Yeah, I'll prescribe fewer antibiotics just to spite that guy.
We had to be really careful, though, and make sure that the figures were correct and give some transparency on how we treated them, because you have to do a few things to make sure the comparison is valid. Mm-hmm. Because we knew that physicians care about this stuff and they would question it, and we didn't want it to be undermined with the idea that it was questionable in some way. So to that flim-flam point, you've really got to underpin it with something real. And if you oversell it, then you're running a risk because people may find out. So yeah, this is about good, reliable evidence presented in a reasonable way. I think that works better over the long term.
Yeah, and transparency is really what I think a lot of people are asking for. I've never seen a doctor who, when given almost any criticism, didn't instantly want to reject that and say, well, the reason I'm not doing as well as this, my patients are sicker. My patients are more complicated. One of the things that I've seen technology really help with is with some of the EHRs now, you can say, here's a list of your patients who haven't met the criteria that we're looking for. Oh no, I know that guy and that guy. This is wrong. Your data are wrong. These people have had it all. And then being able to kind of like click through the list and go like, well, let's open up the chart. Nope, this one's right. Look, this is where that information would be. It's not here. So that means you didn't do it. That's really been kind of transformational.
I would say though, Craig, that what you need as well is to give people an off-ramp. The point here is not to sort of say, look, you were wrong, because that may not lead to the change in behavior. It may actually be much better to provide an off-ramp so people don't have a confrontation and they can just quietly go and make some adjustments themselves. That's some of the evidence we see. This reactance, where you do a public challenge, is actually the problem. And so you need to be really careful about how you do that to get to the best place overall.
And that's why you two work at BIT and I do not. I can get you 75% of the way. It's that last 25% that you really need help with. Michael, one of the things that your team has worked on, or at least BIT has worked on, is helping an insurance company create an internal nudge unit. And so you would kind of reference the book Nudge at the beginning of our conversation. So what's a nudge unit, and why does an insurance company in Massachusetts need one?
A nudge unit can be many different things, but in essence, it is a collection of expertise that knows about behavioral science and works to apply that knowledge to practical issues within your organization. And so in a health insurance context, you might have instances a bit like the one we just discussed, where you're trying to get to better performance by the healthcare system. You're trying to reduce unnecessary wait times. You're trying to, for example, prevent overprescription of antibiotics and other things like that, where this may affect the ratings you get, the way that funds are allocated, all that kind of thing. At the same time, you may also be looking at your health system users, and do they understand what they need to be doing? Do they go to preventative care screenings, for example? Do they take advantage of some of the benefits that are on offer? In both those kind of categories, whether it's health system focused as in the people running the health system, whether it's in terms of people delivering care or the people receiving care, there are many opportunities to influence behavior. And so what we've done over the last 5 years is helped Blue Cross Blue Shield Massachusetts build a nudge unit that can do these things. They can provide the internal advice to other parts of the organization, for example, how do you do marketing and so on, that ensure that you're doing it so it's aligned with behavioral science, but also running projects themselves to test and improve how the insurance company itself functions. And I think that mentality of bringing in an experimental mindset, thinking, don't just do something, but we also try and think about how we can test it and then continually improve, really kind of pays off. This is something we've helped them do, and we have seen, results in a whole range of areas, whether it's, colorectal cancer screenings or collecting demographic information, statin prescriptions. And I'll also say, sometimes we found things that didn't work. We identified problems. So one example might be one time we included a deadline saying, please respond by this point. And that can often work, but the realities of implementing things may be quite different. So for example, what we found is that delays in the letters actually being sent out in the postal system meant the deadline had already passed for some people by the time they got the letter. And so obviously then the deadline made it worse. And we just noticed this stuff in the data and thought, what is going on here? And we eventually pieced it together that actually deadlines can backfire because the postal service is unreliable. As a crucial kind of insight, but we wouldn't have got it if we hadn't been testing to see how these communications were landing. So it's basically building that behavioral science capability into the way a health insurer works and get some really tangible outcomes.
Yeah, I hate it when the real world gets in the way of the ideal workflow.
This really happened once. About 15 years ago, I actually was in the UK Tax Authority, and I was running these experiments about how to get people to pay their taxes. I spent ages setting one up. And then 2 days before it was meant to happen, the department ran out of paper for the first time in its entire, never happened before or since. They couldn't send any letters because they'd forgotten to order paper. I was like, you cannot anticipate some of this stuff.
That sounds, well, it's good to know that it's not just in the United States where things like this happen.
Yep, incompetence everywhere, don't worry
about it. Yeah, well, it's great. Well, while I have you, why don't we talk a little bit more about the hypocrisy trap? Are there areas of that of your book that are more specific to healthcare that you would say, this really hit home with regard to how hospitals are run or how physicians communicate with their patients?
Yes. So one example that comes to mind is I talk about how sometimes we like hypocrisy or we think it can be effective. And so I talk about the relatable hypocrite. And the example is from a health context where there's some evidence that some doctors are really health focused and advertise how healthy they are and they have an active lifestyle and all these kind of things. The evidence shows that people who are overweight or obese actually will avoid those doctors and find them less effective as advocates for losing weight, because these people feel like they're going to get judged and looked down on. So they actually will avoid that conversation, avoid those doctors, because those doctors aren't hypocrites, right? They're doing what they're preaching, but that actually makes them more unrelatable, and like they can't sympathize with the kind of the struggle of things. So actually, the evidence was that maybe you're not completely perfect yourself. You can have a more constructive conversation because you're not seen as unrelatable. You often get this in the kind of climate advocacy space. We have this thing called do-gooder derogation, where, yeah, we don't like hypocrites, but actually the person who's super consistent, super sustainable, incredibly healthy is also not the best advocate because we can't relate to them and they make us kind of feel a bit bad. So yeah, it comes up in this instance where sometimes hypocrisy can feel like not necessarily the right thing to do, but it can make you more effective.
Yeah, what I'm taking away is that I should go get a hamburger and some French fries.
Yeah, I think, yeah, absolutely. Is that
the wrong message?
That is what I'm saying, Craig, yes. That is what I'm saying.
All right.
What I am saying is it can work the other way as well. So if you are someone who is advocating for something that you maybe someone suspects you're not doing yourself, what you should do is this tactic called honest hypocrisy, where you acknowledge this and you say that, you know, you think it's important, you don't always manage to live up to it yourself, but here are some tactics to make it more likely you can live up to it yourself. Whereas if you just pretend everything's fine, you don't acknowledge the struggles and the issue, and yet yourself, you're not doing it, that also can be a problem. So yeah, there are many tactics we can use to try and be more consistent with our goals. And in the book, I talk about how we can do that, like setting commitments for ourselves to make it more likely we follow through, or even this tactic called induced hypocrisy, which is where you do something like you get someone to commit publicly to an issue. Like maybe you could say everyone should, I don't know, get screened for a particular disease. And then in private, you remind people of all the times they didn't do that. Like, did you get a flu shot yourself? You just made this big statement saying everyone should do it. And there's some evidence that if you do this, people change their behavior as a result to come into line with that public attitude they've stated. But the key is don't confront people in public. Because if you do it in public, you get that kind of reactance I spoke about, Craig, where it's with doctors, you know, confronting them, you need to provide this off-ramp. If you do it in public, it can backfire. And you say, well, maybe I didn't really care about that anyway, and I'm just going to keep what I'm doing what I'm doing. You do in private, you give people space to reflect, and then that's more likely to lead to change.
Yeah, no, that is excellent advice. Well, we have gotten to the end of our time, and I always want to end with the same question we ask our guests, which is there something that's so well designed that it brings you joy and happiness whenever you interact with it? Meredith is nodding her head. So Meredith, go ahead.
Yes, I have a toddler. He's very, very messy. And they have these bibs now that are pretty ubiquitous. They're everywhere. But every time I put this bib on him, I just get such a deep sense of gratitude because it's like a bowl at the end of it. And so it catches, I would say, like 70% of the mess that he's going to make. And not only that, he actually loves putting it on because he knows it's almost the second bowl after his dinner. Like there's the dinner on his plate and then there's the dinner in his bib. And every time I put it on, I'm thankful for whoever invented it.
Excellent. All right. Michael, anything come to mind?
The first thing that came to mind was the kitchen knife I use. But then I think that makes me seem a bit weird. The handle feels quite right. So I'm actually going to say the front cover of my book, which actually is really a beautiful design that someone called Jack Story created about this kind of interlocking pattern of blue and white hands pointing at each other. I think it's really, really quite satisfying to look at.
Excellent. Well, I think both of those answers, a knife that feels good in your hand is completely acceptable. So we could have gone with that. But I think the cover design of your book is equally good. Well, Michael Hollisworth, Meredith Jones, thank you so much for joining us. I think we learned a lot. There's a lot to contemplate there. And Michael, good luck with your book. I hope it gets continued good reviews. I know already you've had some and you get a lot of people thinking about those ideas.
Thanks, Craig. I really appreciate that.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. For more on Hollisworth and Jones, follow them on LinkedIn or see some of their work online at bi.team. Also, you can find Dr. Hollisworth's latest book, The Hypocrisy Trap, for sale online or at many bookstores. Check back for more episodes of Designing for Health wherever you listen to podcasts or on nordicglobal.com. We'll see you again next time on Designing for Health.
If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. This helps others find the podcast as well.